Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to the Front Three. It's lovely to have you, and I'm joined by Dave. Dave, welcome.
Hello.
And
How are you, Lauren?
I'm pretty good. You know why I'm good? Because Adam's in Barcelona, probably taking an E, and we're back here in England. Adam's away having a great time. So this week we are not joined by Adam, but we brought in another person to fill in on the Front Three. And when I say fill in, I mean sub in. Joel, otherwise known as Miss Seconds, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope you two are well.
Yeah, we are pretty good. We're pretty good. I'm kind of interested in where you got your name from. Where did you get your name?
Oh, it's a bad story.
Yeah.
When we started Messy Minutes, I wanted it to be called Seagulls and Trawlers, the Eric Cantona reference.
Yeah. No trawler.
But the other two, because we were making a YouTube show and it was supposed to last a few minutes, and Messy's kind of football-y and alliterative.
Yeah.
And then Messy Seconds just kind of sprung out of that for obvious reasons.
So it's just clickable, basically.
Yeah.
Are you actually a big Messy fan? Was it sort of?
Not hugely. Not in any disproportionate way.
Great, because Dave's a big fan of Squawker, and that's why he named himself Squawker.
That is why, Lawrence, mate. He's through and through. I'm going to get a tattoo next year, pal.
Yeah. Squawker Dave, and Messy Minutes is obviously the other place you can follow. So if people want to find you and they don't know who you are right now, then they just need to search for Messy Seconds. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, it's lovely to have you. Thanks a lot for filling in for Adam this week. Adam's obviously away. He'll be back in time. Don't worry about that. But there's been a big week of news, so we're just going to get straight into it on the podcast. Check to Arsenal. Brackets confirmed, Dave. Now, I just saw some interesting tweets about this. Someone said, I don't know. They know he's a good goalkeeper, but they don't like when people say he's got a winning mentality. And they believe it's just because you won something doesn't give you a winning mentality. And to some extent, I agree with it. But what does he actually bring to Arsenal in terms of the tangible things that he'll bring to the back line?
Well, for me, it's absolutely massive signing Peter Cech. I've always said Arsenal have had a massive weakness in the goalkeeping thing.
Even when they're good goalkeepers. Even when they are good goalkeepers, you're like, he's weak.
Yeah, no, I would say so. You know, the likes of Jens Lehmann, he was a brilliant keeper, but he was a little bit nutty. And I think what Peter Cech brings is this calm and influence in the back four. You look at his stats, they're pretty incredible. He's got the most clean sheets in Premier League history. He's got the record in 2004, 2005 for the most clean sheets with 21. He's won that award three times, the Golden Glove. And I just really do think that he's this missing link between Arsenal being fourth and being top. I think a goalkeeper is absolutely massive for winning the Premier League. And I reckon, you know, Joel's probably going to back me up here that he's a quality signing for Arsenal.
You've got to be a bit nuts to be a goalkeeper, firstly. Do you remember Otto Burch? He used to have... someone made like a parody blog of him being really angry all the time when he was at Celtic. That was wonderful.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Petr Cech is a fantastic player. I'm not quite jumping on the best signing in history thing.
Like that really would be mental, wouldn't it? To be to call him the best signing in history. Yeah,
for sure. But even that kind of, you know, Ozil Alexis-ish signing.
Yeah.
He's fantastic. He's legendary. He's amazing. Other superlatives. But, like, sure, 33 isn't that old for a keeper. He's getting on a little bit. He has maybe declined since injury. He wasn't great under Vyas Boris's high line, which maybe won't be a problem as much next season at Arsenal as we kind of play back with Mertesacker, etc. and he's possibly not 100% needed. He's a great signing, and I don't think he's a big risk because he's not that much money and he's clearly world class.
Yep.
But I don't think that he will propel Arsenal to some sort of title winning hopes.
Interesting, because you're one of the few Arsenal fans that seems to... Well, not few.
I'm not an Arsenal fan.
Not really. Really? Because I always thought of you as an Arsenal fan. I don't know why. Is it because you hang out with so many Arsenal guys?
Maybe. I think it's because Messy Minutes tweets Arsenal a lot, but I'm always tweeting the non-Arsenal stuff.
Okay, but then you're as what I'm interested in then is the idea basically that he is good, and but you know he's essentially been behind a very good back line at Chelsea for quite some time, and at times has been a little bit flappable. This is going to be quite a different test for Cech, so. You know, it's going to be interesting to see defensively how Arsenal manage to measure up. And Dave, you were saying earlier today, it's not a terrible idea if they put another good centre-back in front of him to partner one of the two guys. But that means they're going to need to build up a partnership in front of him and make it into a unit.
That definitely, you know, that's a massive thing. Again, talking about title-winning sides, you've always got a good goalkeeper. You've always got two very, very good centre-halves in front. And I think Arsenal have got one good centre-half in Koscielny, but I think, you know, Gabriel Paulista, you know, hasn't learned English yet. You know, that's going to be he's still got to adapt to the Premier League. You've got Mertesacker that definitely isn't top class. You know, look at the game against Monaco where he was pulled out to the flanks and he was defending in those wide areas and literally just looked like he was on ice skates, couldn't handle it at all. Personally, what I thought about today was if Arsenal sign Matt Hummels this summer, that will be an ultimate back three. You know, you look at the two centre-halves, Hummels and Koscielny, complement each other brilliantly, and then you've got Peter Cech behind. That would be an absolute dream combo for all Arsenal fans. One thing that I was just thinking about a second ago, Arsenal signings in like the last four windows, you got Santi Cazorla, I think it was 2012, then Mesut, who came in 2013, then they had Alexis Sanchez, and now they've signed Peter Cech. That is a pretty decent record, you know, after the new stadium's been built, and you're thinking Arsenal are really building something here. I reckon they'll win the league in the next three seasons.
That's interesting, Dave. Big claim. Are you willing to put €1,000 on it?
I did say €1,000 before. I'm going to change that to 1,000 Chinese yen, you know, exchange rates and that type of thing. I was looking at it today. And I think that's where I'm going to go, you know. I'll be skint if I put all that cash on.
Apparently so. But, I mean, someone who certainly isn't skim right now is Man City, and the fact that they're trying to sign Sterling for such a huge amount of cash. I've been interested in the last few days, people talking about what he's worth. We discussed it this morning on Football Daily Weekly, Dave, and I'm interested to get your view on this one, Joel. Everyone else has had their say. So, you know, in what way is Sterling worth 50 million? And is that even the main... Should that even really be the main subject here?
I'm not sure there are... specific prices that you can put on a player. It's how much they're worth to a particular club. And when you're looking at Manchester City, who have really bad structural squad issues, I mean, they clearly have some incredible... I mean, most of their squad is made up of incredible players, but they're all getting on. And they really need both English players for obvious reasons and younger players for also obvious reasons in summer. Sterling and Jack Wilshere make... like more than sense. There is no one better than they can buy. They can't just buy another five Scott Sinclairs and play them all on the bench. And so to them, yeah, I think he's worth that much.
That's interesting. I mean, Dave, you made the point earlier today that basically he's worth it to City because of what City spend on other players and, you know, basically the relative market value right now. And, you know, people making arguments about what everyone else is worth. We've heard about his stats. We've heard about all those kind of things. The biggest question is, do you think it's actually a good move for Sterling?
I'd say no. I think Sterling needs to play, like Joel just mentioned there about all these players we've got, like Sinclair, you know, Rodwell. These players were super talented, you know, youngish English players. They all went to Man City and they all, you know, sat on the bench. Sterling obviously is a different breed, but again, I think his development would have been a hell of a lot better staying at Liverpool, playing consistently, you know, working on his finishing, working on parts of his game. You know, he's going to have to go into City and he's going to have to play every week. He's not going to have a little period where he can go and have a holiday in Jamaica, is he really?
Well, you know, we don't know that. We don't. I mean, you know, if you can afford a private jet, then which you probably will be able to on those wages, then you can afford a little holiday anywhere. But I guess the point would be that it's a very different culture at City to the one that was being cultivated at Liverpool by Brendan Rodgers. And a lot of people are saying, a lot of people take for granted the development of a player and that he will just continue along that that trajectory, if you like. So I guess the interesting thing is how City will look to develop Sterling ahead of you know, other players and whether he will get in the squad week in, week out. It's certainly been interesting to see. And, you know, Blue Moon Rising TV seem to be covering it pretty much all the time right now. So maybe that's worth a look as well. Now, Dave, news from the Bundesliga.
Oh, baby. Jonathan Gietha, you know, Joel is going to go mad on this lad. He has joined Schalke. A massive, massive signing for Schalke. But, you know, me personally, I watched Schalke last season a lot. They look like a bunch of headless chickens. They look like they were running around. There was no control in the game. They've got a lot of young, talented players, the likes of Max Meyler, the likes of Julian Draxler, the likes of, was it Sana that kicked off last season, scored that brilliant goal against Real. And they really lack this holding midfielder slash centre-mid. And I really think Keith is going to be the man to do that. You look at his passes in the Bundesliga last season, I think only one Schalke player completed more passes than him. He racked out 1,155 passes, you know, decent passing stats. Created 73 chances. I think that's the fourth most in the Bundesliga. One thing he could improve on is his pass accuracy. He's sitting at 73%, which is pretty poor for a centre mid. But he is a playmaker. He does try the passes that are not on so much. Joel, what are you saying about him?
It's interesting. I think, Dave, you're right talking about Schalke and how they were last season. Definitely, it looked for a few seasons like Jens Keller was just on the brink of being sacked and he never quite left. Until Di Matteo came in and didn't do the best of jobs. He's interesting. I'm not sure what I think. He's the kind of player that I usually wouldn't like. He's a midfield player in like defensive midfield area that takes a huge amount of shots per game, right? If you're 20 years old and you're starting for Mainz, who last season I think finished seventh or something, and you're managing to always start and to shoot four times per game, that is crazy for a defensive midfielder. The number of long balls he tries is mental, but I wonder if that makes him appear a little too active on the ball. I wonder if there are better decisions that sometimes he could and should make. And certainly, usually, I wouldn't be very interested in things like pass accuracy. But when it's as low as like low 70s, you know, you're looking at a potential problem at least.
I suppose you wonder whether that will be honed within a league where the expectation is different on him. I guess, you know, we speak about the difference in culture with Sterling and City, whether it's the same with Schalke and the, you know, the technical ability that they have within that squad, whether they believe that they can get a similar product here, if that makes sense.
Yeah. He's a very different option for them. I think he will work. Their defensive midfielders, a lot of the time last season, they just stuck three centre-backs at the back and two more centre-backs in central midfield.
Yeah. With Neustadter, is that his name?
Exactly, Neustadter.
Neustadter, yeah. He's, you know, very, very defensive-minded player, passes sideways, that type of thing. That's where I think Gietha can come in and really, you know, spread it around. He might be a bit of a risk, but I think that 73% pass accuracy will improve, you know, going to Schalke, learning a bit more. You know, changing him, you know, changing going from Mainz to Schalke, it's a big step up for him. But, you know, you've got a lot of young, talented German players there. I really just think he's going to shine.
Well, shine away, Schweinsteig away, if you will, Dave. We're moving on to United and the possible signing of Bastian Schweinsteiger and Sergio Ramos. Now, we should probably separate the two out and say the reason this is interesting is because, A, these are two huge names of European football, both with a lot of Champions League experience and both pretty much veterans within their squad. But an even more interesting thing last season, Dave, was that at times the formation that Louis van Gaal picked didn't look balanced and the team didn't seem to have very much balance. And it seemed to inhibit them at times from playing the kind of football they wanted. If they've got to experience guys, or these are the kind of player they're looking to bring in, it might indicate that he's looking to balance out the team a little bit more and maybe take some of the weight off the players who were slightly further forward last season from defending, etc. It's interesting to see that they're targeting these guys ahead of, say, a striker right now or someone else. They're going for Ramos and Schweinsteiger. So should we go with Ramos first? What are we saying about Sergio Ramos and the possible ridiculously expensive signing of Sergio?
Well, you know, if David De Gea goes and we get, you know, we could bring Matt Ramos in as our marquee signing, you know, it'll be absolutely fantastic. He is one of the, you know, top five centre-halves in European football. He's a brilliant ball player. He's really aggressive. He's the type of player that United need, a leader at the back, someone that will take the responsibility. At times, Man United look a bit scared, you know, that the centre-halves had the ball in their sort of centre-half area and they didn't want to drive with it. They didn't want to, you know, play forward passes, or they drive it and then play a backwards pass. And I think Sergio Ramos really does give you that. He gives you passion, he gives you hunger, he gives you aggression. He just has everything a modern centre half. But a signing at 29, you know, how many more years is he going to have at the top level? I think with centre half, you either go one of two ways. You either lose your pace and you completely lose it, a la when Rio Ferdinand, I was struggling for his bloody name then.
Ex-United player,
when he hit a certain age, he lost his pace and he lost his game. Ramos, will he be the same way, or will he go down the line of being a Maldini, being a Nesta, improving with age? I think he'll go down that line, to be honest. I think he's a player that came to Real Madrid very raw, very young. You know, he had a lot of problems with his game, and he's really built on that. You know, now he's getting booked less. He's making the sillier tackles less. I think it's that type of player that United might need. Leader at the back, old experience, but the question marks are still there whether we are going to spend too much money on him, I'd say.
And Joel, Schweini, a lot of people are painting him as somewhat of a fading European power, which is maybe a little bit unfair on the World Cup winner and still very much a leader within any squad that he'd probably be in. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see the balance of that United midfield with a Schweinsteiger and a Daily Blind in there or something, if that was the case. Do you even think... I mean, that's the question, is it worth getting Schweinsteiger, or do you think there are better options for United?
I think it's a strangely intelligent signing.
They're not good at those intelligent signings. Yeah.
they're not amazing. Last transfer window, some of those players that came in were great. But I think the vast majority of them, maybe the exception of like Daily Blind, but the majority of them were overpriced. Like even Di Maria, who is without any doubt, maybe some doubts after this season, but relatively no doubt, a world-class player. Mm-hmm. 60 million, is he worth that much? It's at least up in the air. A Schweinsteiger that is slightly behind the pecking order at Bayern Munich.
To be fair, that's behind some great players in the and possibly behind a system there. But yeah,
of course, he's behind some fantastic players. But Xabi Alonso is included in them. He's not looking to get into the squad anytime soon. Well, as in like the absolute first team starter, like what Robin is. He only has a year left on his contract, mm-hmm. and he's still a world class midfielder. It's quite a Juventus signing. I think it's good.
Or is it quite a Van Gaal signing? I mean, that's an interesting angle to take on it. Then Louis Van Gaal maybe wants a player like this within his team that he knows he can technically rely on, someone who can tactically switch it up, someone who's very good at switching from deeper midfield to more attacking. And he's looking to bring in players that maybe look a bit more tactically adaptable. Because in England, you know, it's almost the perception is very often you pick your starting 11 and then that sort of goes from there and you can tinker a little bit. But we've seen a lot of tinkering from Van Gaal, and I'm just wondering whether he's looking for players who allow him to do that a little bit more.
Tinkable players, in a way, where you've got, like, obviously Schweinsteiger. Van Gaal was the reason why he played central midfield. You know, like you're saying, Lawrence, he'll give great tactical flexibility. He could play, you know, he could play six, holding in front of the defence. He could play eight, being the link between midfield and attack. And he could play 10, probably. You know, he sort of played 10 towards the end of the season for Bayern Munich, you know, popped up with a few goals. He's definitely an interesting signing, but I don't know whether it's the right way. I think it's where Louis Van Gaal's going to take Man United. Is he going to bring in Ramos and Schweinsteiger, who are sort of older players, and Van Gaal will be there for maybe two more years, and then we'll get a new manager in? Or does he want to completely change it up, sign some real young, exciting talent, or some players that are probably, you know, 23, 24, and then sort of move United on? Or is it going to be sort of a holding phase, you know, a Mourinho three more years type thing, where it'll get the performance levels up really high, and then someone will have to come in and breathe some more life into the side? I'm not sure.
I'd be interested to see how he aids development.
Maybe United will want to get back into the Champions League. I mean, obviously they are, but they'll want to keep in those spots and really confirm them. And perhaps that is more important than other long-term goals. Young players would be really exciting and interesting right now. But in a period where there's still some doubt that United get to get top four in a given season, maybe it's that solidity and that the reputation that comes with that that they're looking at. I mean, United are never going to go down the AC Milan, Inter Milano route of dropping out the Champions League. You lose the money, you lose the players, blah, 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 because, you know, Manchester United are a super club. But it's at least a consideration.
Mm. And Dave, it's been interesting to... You pasted something into our show notes, which basically is all of the players United have been linked with. I mean, this is... is interesting. It's also slightly ridiculous because obviously you can be linked with anyone, and it may not be realistic. But there are some good names in there, and it probably shows the perception outside of United, even if the players don't go in the end.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. You know, I might even go for, I'm going to go for it. Right, let's go with the goalkeepers first. So we've got Cillessen from Ajax, Hugo Lloris and Bernd Leno from Leverkusen. They're the goalkeepers. Right back, we've got Nathaniel Klein, Seamus Coleman and Fabiano from Monaco and Gregory Van der Veel from PSG. Then centre half, we've been, you know, linked with a number of these. Matt Hummels, Otamendi, Rom Vlaar, big shout out to Big Rom, Sergio Ramos. We haven't, in fact, been linked with any left backs, which is quite interesting in its own right.
But Dave, who would you prefer of all those guys you've been linked with there? The back four?
If I were to go with two, okay, so three, let's say. Three or two?
No, two. Two, just give me two.
Two?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to go with Fabiano, Monaco, really like him.
Interesting.
And I would love Matt Hummels.
Okay, cool. So, but not Otamendi, because that if you watch Full Time Devils, that's basically, it might as well be Otamendi Time Devils.
No, he's a really good player. You know, whenever I've seen him, he's been pretty classy. His best performance this year came against Real Madrid, actually, when Valencia turned them over. I do think he's a very good player, watching him in the copper as well. He looks very strong. Mm-hmm. He's decent on the ball. He's just a good centre-half. But I think Hummels, I think ball-playing-wise, is the next level. You know, he really is a ball-playing centre-back. He's so, so good on the ball. It's ridiculous. And he's so calm on the ball. I think that's what we need. We need a calming influence. And I think Otamendi might not bring that.
No, okay, fair enough. No left-back moving into midfield. It's going to be quite interesting there, because there are some big and then technically gifted names in there.
Yeah, right. Let's start with the sort of defensive-minded midfielders. Well, the more defensive-minded midfielders. We've got Bastian Schweinsteiger, I mentioned before. Gundogan, Vidal, Schneiderlin, Bilagli. Then more Pogba, sorry. Then more attacking midfielders. We've got Schneider, Gattin, Muller, Ronaldo, Firmino, Anderson, Felipe Anderson, sorry. Gareth Bale. Then the strikers. There's so many of these as well. Harry Kane, Benzema, Cavani, Higuain, Bakker and Lacazette. That is the list.
Some questionable pronunciation in there of some names, Dave, but I'll forgive the accent there. Liverpool are allegedly in for Firmino now. What did United want from him?
I think they wanted, obviously, his goals and assists in the Bundesliga. I think he's been directly involved. He's been directly involved in 44 goals in the last two seasons, only beaten by one of the midfielders. So that's what he's going to give you, is the output. He's so good at finishing. He's so calm. It's quite interesting to watch him in the copper. You know, he's been pretty decent. So, you know, it'll be a very good signing for whoever gets him at Liverpool or United. I just question him. Where does he fit in at Liverpool, though, Lawrence?
Well, I guess what they're looking for there is someone that I guess would be even more aggressive than the players they have right now. But, I mean, I'd be I'd be interested to see where he fits in, considering the, allegedly, the amount of competition they have there between Markovic. Although, Firmino seems to fulfil a more central role, which is maybe where Liverpool, I don't know, they feel like they've got some gifted players there, but he looks like he goes into the box quite well. Looks like he finishes quite a few moves. Looks like he's quite good in build-up. So maybe he's, again, another sort of first-team option.
Yeah.
Slightly more direct than Coutinho.
Yeah, I'd say so, definitely. More of a finisher and a, you know, in-the-box type player. You know, he's getting you assists in those types of areas.
Fashionably aggressive, I think, would be the answer right now. And sometimes,
yeah, he's definitely a very active player.
Yeah, which is what Brendan Rodgers likes. He loves a good active player.
He's the guy that contributes a lot of shots. And that's definitely something United need now. It's probably something that Liverpool will need, especially if Sterling goes.
Well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how many shots Liverpool actually get on goal next season if Sterling's not there. Dave, what about West Ham signings? Is it Payet or Payet? Which one are we going for here?
I'd go for Payet. What do you reckon, Joel?
I was going to go for Payet, but I guess I'll do it better than you guys.
Hey, whatever. We've all given our slice of Payet, so Dave, tell me now.
Well,
that was worse than some of the Petr Cech things I've heard today.
Oh, check yourself before you wreck yourself. Thank you.
Lawrence, I love it, mate. I love it. But no, he's a top player. He's played for, obviously, Bielsa's Marseille this season. He's played in a number of positions on the left, on the right, and behind the striker. He's just he's an all-round top sort of player, very
top
tricky
bloke,
on the ball. He's a top bloke as well. You know, he's not a good guy, actually.
Yeah.
He's kicked off a bit in his career, which is an interesting thing. And I think that's why he hasn't got his big move, because he's quite a vocal player. When he wants to move, he'll make it very, very prominent to people. But in fact, he's created more chances than any other player in Europe's top five leagues. So he's one of those players that can create something for West Ham this in the next season under under Bilic is going to be quite interesting. It's 134 chances that he created for Marseille, 17 assists. You know, he's a very, very good player, but potentially he's, you know, been linked with West Ham to get another deal a la Sergio Ramos. Joel, what do you reckon?
It's an interesting transfer. It's being relatively reliably reported. I think The Guardian have been carrying it this week. Yeah. There's also, well, the rumour is that West Ham are putting in a second bid of 14, 15 million, and that he'll be offered another contract at Marseille. They're being torn apart this summer, aren't they?
They are, aren't they?
It's sad. It's after such a brilliant season with, like, yeah, really interesting football. Payet's possibly going, Imbula's possibly going, Andre Ayew, has he already gone to Swansea?
He's already gone.
Morel went to Lyon. Yeah. There must be more.
You know, you'd expect players like Nkulu to probably leave. You know, he's been head and shoulders above the rest of the defenders. Yeah, poor Marseille, I agree with you. What's Bielsa going to do next year? He's going to have to do some, you know...
Well, he's only on his... It's not a big problem, Dave. He'll be off at least in another season or so. So it's for him, I can pretty much keep in mind. Speaking of building long-term projects, let's talk Juve signings. Mandzukic. Is Mandzukic a confirmed signing there now?
Yeah, I think it was confirmed yesterday evening.
I think
pictures on the Juve Twitter.
Along with Pereira, Khedira and Dybala, which is a great name in the first place. Those are some interesting signings there, Dave, to counter what most people are billing as the alleged exodus of the summer, which is possibly Pirlo, Tevez and Pogba. Maybe two of those will leave, maybe Pogba not so much, but this is again more re-equipping from Juve with again another what seemed like intelligent buying, Khedira, Mandzukic. It's just fascinating to see what Allegri is going to try and do with these guys now.
It's absolutely brilliant. He's still in the market for an attacking midfielder as well. You know, he's been linked with Oscar, I think, recently. But those signings are fantastic. You know, if they're going to lose Tevez, you know, obviously a player that can press from the front, Mandzukic is the perfect man. You know, if you're going to lose Pirlo, you've already got somewhere there that's built in that role. And Marchisio can just fit in there, play exactly the same as a Pirlo role, and you're sorted. You know, signing the likes of Pereira on a full, you know, on a full deal from Udinese, and then signing Khedira on a free. That, you know, if Pogba goes, they've already dealt with it. And then someone like Dybala, you know, someone that literally blew Serie A away in the first half of the season. A fantastic young talent. I think he's Argentinian, but he's of Polish descent. You look at his stats at the start of the season, he's brilliant, you know, goals, assists. Really, really talented player, but I think Juve are really going in the right way. They're just, you know, the signings that they've made in the last few years have just been ridiculous.
Mm. Joel, I mean, what do you think of the general policy that Juve seem to be operating under here? Because, I mean, look, they seem to pair quite well with Allegri right now.
It's awesome. They're signing so many different types of players. You would have thought that Allegri would have done such a bad job, but he's done pretty well, especially changing the system, the long-term 3-5-2 to the four at the back and then generally two strikers up front that they currently play. Yeah. The variety of players they've signed, that's almost like a clear but also slightly hazy transfer policy. So some of their players, they buy young players for nothing. They buy Koeman, they buy Pogba. Some players, they get young prospects and they really put the money out, like United did with Wayne Rooney, Buffon, Dybala, Morata. And older players for free. Khedira, Mandzukic, not free, but pretty cheap. I think Mandzukic and Khedira are amazing. I think they're still possibly just about world class. I think they're both great players. Not a Dybala fan myself.
Why?
But he's very active. I thought he was very lucky given his shots earlier in the season. And his, when you look at the metrics of how he's contributing to goal difference, as opposed to just the number of goals he scored, which isn't always the most reliable of counting numbers, he doesn't necessarily stand up to scrutiny. I mean, he's a young player, so you can never, ever say anything definitively. But I would have other people over him.
I'm not sure. I look at, you know, do some basic counting, and he's rocking, you know, 13 goals in the league and 10 assists. He's the only player in Serie A to get double figures for those stats, apart from Barabi, you know, another talented youngster.
Double.
Whenever I've seen him, when I saw Dybala at the start of the season, he was very explosive and he was very involved. But I think the move that was sort of engineered in January sort of killed him a bit. It killed his season. It seemed like he was like, oh, I've done it now. Maybe that's a problem with that attitude, like you're saying. You know, maybe he did it a little bit of luck, you know, and whatever. But I really do think he will, you know, eventually be a really, really top player. But it'll be interesting to see how Juve deal with him. I think Juve have got one of the best records in getting these talented youngsters to being world-class stars. And I think that's what we'll probably see with Dybala in the next few years.
Let's finish this section with a question about Danny Ings, because as if no one has spoken about him enough. Obviously, it's interesting to see what he's going to be doing on the pitch next season. But off the pitch, he's picked number 28 within the squad. And he said within that it's because he didn't want to pick a number which maybe he didn't feel he'd earned yet, or at least words to those to those effect. I mean, it's quite an interesting approach, isn't it, Joel? I mean, at least he's not going in there and going, give me the nine. I suppose he can't have the nine or ten because Liverpool have got those numbers filled right now. But it's still interesting to see that, you know, he's going to be rocking that 28 again to just to see what happens and see whether he earns a number above that.
It's a very English thing to care about.
Do you think?
Yeah,
but he is English. I mean,
In Italy, they'll pick whatever. Is Shaarawy still El Shaarawy still rocking
92? 92.
Somewhere ridiculous.
Ronaldinho had like a. Did he have 88 or 90? He had something ridiculous for a while, didn't he?
Yeah, something crazy. The idea that young players have to like earn their place is something that seems to be quite popular among Liverpool fans. So you know. It's at the very least, it's a nice PR move.
Does that mean he's three better than Sterling? That's all I'm wondering. What I am wondering is, what would your number be if you were to take an obscure number? What would you go for?
16.
That's not obscure. That's an absolutely normal number to take.
It's the number I'd go for.
Okay, but what if say 16 was filled? So, you know, you've come to a side and Didi Haman's already there. What are you doing? What number? Come on.
61. It's 16 backwards.
Oh, I
was pressured into it.
Hold on a minute. Do we have to get Adam back? Because I reckon this is a pretty good... Okay, no. I'm being told in my ear we do actually have to. It's contractually obliged to bring Adam back. But that's a great answer. Dave, what are you going to go for?
I'm going to go for 45.
Why?
It's just the day I was born, the 4th, and then the 5th the month of the year. Sorry, guys. Dead boring, but that was always been my number.
Yeah, you and basically Mario
Balotelli. A lot of other people. Yeah. Oh, yes. Get in.
That's a good point, actually. I'd go even higher than that. I'd go more obscure. I'd go Italian obscure. I'd go like 83 kind of area.
Okay.
That was the house number of my grandma as a child.
Oh, mate, you've nailed it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And the Italians love that sort of shit. So, let us know what your numbers would be. I'd be really interested to know what you go for. 99, by the way, you probably shouldn't have. I'm just saying. Can you go? You can't even go to. Can you go to 100? Can you go above 100? Or does it just go zero?
Trivia question.
That's a good question.
Yeah,
that's a great question.
There's going to be someone who's dedicated enough for the podcast to look it up.
I hope so. I can't wait for that
because I won't. Anyway, that's the end of part one. Part two, we're going through your questions. Leading into part two, and we're going to go with Joel first. Joel, the question arose as to who you actually do support. So, who do you support?
It's not the kind of answer that I think football fans want to hear.
All right.
But I don't really support anyone. I mean, I grew up going to the Emirates a lot because a lot of my friends supported Arsenal and I went to quite a few away games because that was a lot of fun. But I'm from Cardiff, so Cardiff City. I work at Bristol City at the moment. The work that Brentford and Michelin are doing in statistics is inspiring. But I probably watch more Schalke, Bayer Leverkusen.
Interesting.
So no one really.
So does that mean? I mean, really, for me, you support a team if your heart beats faster when you see them play. Do you have that experience with more teams? Like, because I'm obviously, you know, I grew up as a Liverpool fan, and you know that means that I am now dedicated to them for a weird human reason, which Ted probably explained in one of their talks. But like, why? You know, who gets your heart beating, or you know, do you literally get excited by going to see Bristol City now, even though you had no affiliation to them that long ago?
It is interesting psychology, isn't it?
Yeah,
I guess I don't have that team. I went around Europe during the World Cup, watching like Germany, France, and France, and being there and being part of that community, that spectacle. That's awesome. Like, I watched the 7-1 Brazil game in Munich on their central street. That was incredible. I think I can generate a one-night love affair with a team without going longer term.
Good God. You're a one-night kind of guy. Something I never thought I'd hear you say. You look like such a wholesome chap when you're chatting around your YouTube channel. And now I find you just, you wake up and you throw Germany out of your bed come the morning.
Don't tell the girlfriend.
Yeah, I definitely won't tell the girlfriend you've slept with all of Germany. Anyway, fantastic. Let us know who whether you guys got a similar relationship with certain teams. Obviously, you know, there are other sports that we dip into. I dip into basketball, picked up a couple of teams in there, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be interesting to see what you guys have got as an experience as well. It's a very modern experience. Although I am told in the past that, you know, I mean, I know someone, another YouTube channel who, when they, he's much older than me, but when they got, when he was younger, he used to get tapes of Ajax sent to him by an Ajax fan, which was taped on VHS. And therefore he built up somewhat of an affiliation with Ajax. And I imagine that there's a similar relationship now, but the internet is so transient, it does sort of allow you to dip in and out. But anyway, yeah, let us know. Speaking of transient relationships, Dave, there are some transient relationships to the championship that some people have. West Brom enjoys such a relationship. Derby did just a few years ago. Norwich City, etc. And the first question comes from Cameron, who says, next week's question should be, who do you think will get promoted to from the championship next season? You think managers are important in influencing this?
I really, really do. I think it's probably the hardest division in the world to get out of. You know, it's so competitive. There's so many teams that could go up. There's so many teams that can go down. And I really do think the manager is so important. You know, you look at the likes of Bournemouth that potentially have spent a few pounds in the last few years. But Eddie Howe, the job that he's done, you know, obviously before he left to Burnley and when he came back, it's just been pretty phenomenal. Really interesting. You watch him on Gary Neville and Jeremy Carragher's show on Monday night on Sky Sports, and yeah. He was really brilliant. He was really informative. He was really exciting. I think that's that's the kind of thing. He's a player that fell out of the game through injury and has really learned. I do think you know the managers bring that. You know, you look at Watford as well that got promoted. You think it's the manager that was in that season. It's Jankovic or something like that. Mm. He's got the best record in terms of win rate in Watford's history as manager. You've got some pretty decent managers in that history, like Gianluca Vialli. You've got, Adi Boothroyd, Malky Mackay, Brendan Rodgers, Sean Dyche, Gianfranco Zola. You know, he's eclipsed all of these managers and he's really, you know, he really forced them up, got them up. That's why I think next season, promoted teams are going to be Derby, because obviously Paul Clement, I reckon Borough because of Karanka, and a kind of other wild card, Birmingham City. Not directly because of, you know, the size of the club and that type of thing, obviously being in the Premier League for, you know, a certain amount of the years. But Gary Rowett's done a really good job since he's come in. I think their form after the second half of the season was absolutely phenomenal. So I reckon potentially they're the three teams that I think are going to go up. Joel, what do you reckon?
I think that's a pretty good throw. Middlesbrough played fantastically sometimes last season, particularly against Brentford. They were wonderful. Paul Clement, very interesting at Derby, who has some wonderful players. Will Hughes is incredible to watch, and I'm still convinced that he will consistently make the England team in the future.
Do you think he may be pulled away from Derby, though? Is that the worry that if they don't go up soon, then someone will pluck him away?
Hasn't he supposed to have been pulled away from Derby for like the past 3 years?
Well, Derby are doing a good job of keeping hold of him, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to imagine that he'll leave at some point. But he is still young.
Unless Derby, of course, do go up. I mean, you know, Derby, we do forget, are somewhat of an institution within football at times. Mm. And, you know, they are somewhat of a sleeping giant, not to use too much of a cliche. So, yeah. Mm. But sorry, Joel, I cut you off mid-flow, really.
I'm biased, so you're not going to get any interesting championship predictions off of me. I've got to go for Bristol City because I work for them, Cardiff City because I come from there, and Brentford because the work they're doing is incredible.
Can you justify any of those? Can you realistically say that those guys are, you
Brentford
know...
Brentford could definitely do it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Brentford could definitely do it.
What's your reasoning behind that? Because there are going to be a lot of people listening to this that maybe don't get so much access to the championship and maybe don't know when you say the work they're doing, what you mean by that.
Okay, Matthew Benham, who is a wonderful man who took physics at Oxford and ran and continues to run a betting company and invested in Michelond and Brentford, and they are running those clubs primarily on the basis of statistics, as opposed to at the moment where people think of stats in football and they think of like Liverpool signing Andy Carroll, which is not exactly a great poster boy.
I suppose the flip of that is Suarez, though, isn't it? Is that people, you know, they sign Suarez.
But,
and
then, but then the reverse flip of that is Stuart Downing and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Their signings haven't been incredible in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
At a lot of these clubs, the analytics team are like a few nerds in the basement that occasionally pop up and speak to the management. And that's, like, fantastic. But when you have management and managers, et cetera, that aren't really statistically literate, they're not going to take those suggestions. And even if they do take those suggestions, because they might not be statistically literate, they might not know which data lists are good and which are bad. You have a sort of lemon and peaches problem, as Daniel Altman so wonderfully put it. And so you have questionable data analysis going along at the moment in football. Brentford and Midtjylland are changing that. For them, they don't have a manager, they have a head coach, and everything from set pieces to transfer policy to the sacking of managers is governed by the numbers.
It's certainly interesting to see the approach, because that also, I mean, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see the kind of football that they play because of that, isn't it? And what kind of style you represent on it, and what therefore that maybe that brings out of the team that you then construct, if that makes
Brentford
sense.
Brentford fans are known to love beautiful football, and it's the style of football that Brentford have played for a while. Rasmus Ankersen, who is one of their two directors of football, co-director of football, has stressed several times that they'll continue to play beautiful passing football next season. So hopefully the cold, sober look at football won't result in cold, sober football itself.
Interesting stuff. Dave, we'll probably move on to, would this be a possible Man United team, and do you think it will happen? Again, Dave, going with a very visual question this week, Dave.
Oh, I do like his team.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Shall I read it out for everyone else who can't see it right now?
Yeah.
We've got Hugo Lloris in goal. We've got right-back Seamus Coleman, centre-back Sergio Ramos partnering Matt Hummels, left-back Luke Shaw, defensive central midfield, we've got Daley Blind and Bastian Schweinsteiger, Ander Herrera at the peak of that triangle, and Di Maria on the right-hand side, Lacazette through the middle, and Memphis Depay on the left-hand side.
I think that is
a brilliant side. Apart from the lack of true defensive midfielder, I'd say that Daley Blind, when he's played in central midfield, has been pretty decent at moving the ball side to side, maybe not incisive as enough. Defensively, he's very good. Then we've got Bastian Schweinsteiger, the other holding midfielder, and Ander Herrera. I'm not sure if that midfield works together. There's a lot of passes there. I don't think there's enough brute force in a way. You know, not that Fellaini is the answer to things, but I think you do need a physical element in your midfield. And I think, you know, someone like Krajowski or someone on that sort of Estelon, maybe even forgotten his name, Morgan Schneidling could come in there. But I do like the fact that he's gone with Seamus Coleman at right back. I think that would be a brilliant signing. And we mentioned Ramos before, and Matt Hummels definitely in there. Hugo Lloris, a perfect replacement for David De Gea. And then the front three that I would love to see, Angel Di Maria, Lacazette and Depay, such fluidity up there. This is a pretty good team, but I can't really see United moving on Seamus Coleman. I can't see them getting Sergio Ramos. But Bastian Schweinsteiger, Hummels, Lloris, Lacazette, could happen.
It's an interesting one, because it would also mean a lot of changes within a side and a team gelling very quickly.
Yes, very, very quickly.
I'm interested to know your opinion. This is maybe old news by this point, but goals and rumours, Joel, saying, is Neymar's four-match ban justified? And would it be the same if it wasn't for Neymar? Some people on COP19 are making the point that they think there's a bit of a vendetta, if you like, against Neymar, which I'm not quite sure I agree with. But
yeah, what's the logic behind that?
Well, the logic is he's great, Joel, and therefore people will want to bring you down because you're great. Not that maybe he is at times going to do something wrong and therefore will probably get a four-match ban because of what he did.
I mean, it's an interesting rhetorical line. I think you could also maybe say that referees might want to keep out of trouble and because of that not send off players like Neymar. I'm not sure why it necessarily holds true. I mean, he headbutted a guy. Like, he has more yellow cards and red cards, I think, than Pepe does in the last 3 years.
Good God. Although Pepe has really cleaned up his act, so...
I've got a fantastic stat here, Joel. This is Joel's stat that you just read there. So, since 2009, Neymar's received 100 yellow cards and 6 red cards, whereas Pepe has only got 77 yellows and 5 reds.
You say
that
only.
That is the facts, Joel.
You say only. Both those are quite high numbers, and they are within another echelon of player receiving red and yellow cards. But still, Joel, it's about the justification of it. And I guess what I'm worried about is the... I mean, I know that it is somewhat of... we're obviously moralising within this. But part of it is you have to operate within the rules. And some people would say, you know, if you headbutt someone, you deserve a four-match ban. there's not really much more to add to that, though. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? Is that, you know, we love to moralise in England about these kind of things, but I don't really know what more there is to it. He's operating within the rules. It's the same as when Luis Suarez handballed it at the World Cup. He got sent off, and you know that's operating within the rules.
Yeah, I'm not really sure where the grey lines are.
Well, although there are quite a few grey lines out there. And that's probably why we have a podcast. So, interestingly here, this is an interesting question. I'm not sure it's one we can actually answer unless, of course, Dave, you have a crystal ball. Do you think, and this one's from Vault Dweller, thanks Finbar McMahon, I want to say, do you think we'll ever see a goal return from a player on the Messi-Ronaldo standards? I'm going to say yes and then throw it out to you guys. Dave?
I am also going to say yes, but I reckon it's going to be maybe 10, 15 years between this individual arises. You look at both of their, Messi and Ronaldo's goal scoring records, they're near one goal a game, which is absolutely ridiculous. You're looking at probably, if you're a really good striker, like a Higuain, I think he's probably around the 0.6 mark, 0.6 goals per game. So having it up to one is absolutely fantastic. And that's why I think that it will take time, but it's going to have to be, you know, another type of player. You know, obviously you've seen Messi with his brilliant talent, then Ronaldo with his development as a player, who's been fantastic. It's going to have to be, imagine the mixture of both of those, then we're going to have a player that's going to eclipse that.
Also because of the structure of the game, the way the game moves forward, you know, that obviously it's evolving in a sense. I guess the problem is that and this is maybe going a little bit too theoretical, but we do have somewhat of an idea of football where progress is always happening. And what we don't maybe see is that sometimes progress isn't just a straight line between scoring more goals and scoring less goals. And there may be some progress in between that where someone comes on and actually plays better team football in a sense, or enhances the team in another way. And I guess, Joel, maybe you'd be an interesting guy to talk to about that, because statistically, or at least analysis wise, you're going to be looking at more than just a player scoring goals.
Yeah, I think generally, it's a very strange thing to say, but I think generally goals are overrated in football, or at the very least, the idea that a particular goal return is representative of a great player,
of value,
I think
is
misleading.
Tell that to Sammy Leto.
I think
Ruud van Nistelrooy, eh? You'll be well upset with those comments.
Good point.
I think about the same as Dave does.
Good. Well done, guys. I think what we did there was we answered that question and managed to sit on the fence just enough. Dave, do you have any questions?
Any questions? Oh, yeah. I've got one for you, Lozcast. An absolute corker. Coming in from... Hold on, let me just scroll down. I can't find the question. It's all over the place. Here we go. From Luca.
Go on, Luca.
At Dream Shake. And he goes for, how long until Benitez gets sat by Real Madrid as the first part and returns to Liverpool? Lozcast, what do you reckon? How long is he going to last?
This is a two-part question, isn't it? And I was thinking about this because not long ago we did talk about the Benitez situation and, you know, how well he fits in at Real Madrid. I mean, people speak about him being a Madridista, those kind of things. But very often we've seen that the narrative for Benitez has not always worked out so well for him. You know, even at Valencia, when he won the league with them, he left somewhat under a cloud because he wanted a lamp and they got him a sofa or something along those lines. And the question here is you know, how much damage has been done to Benitez's A, reputation, and B, management acumen and skills in the time that he suffered from Liverpool through to Napoli, where people argue that he underachieved, etc. And how much of that is just perception of media? And how much of that is also English media looking in on a very foreign culture, and a culture which maybe we don't understand as well in England, or maybe slightly resent? Will he be sacked by Real Madrid? The likelihood is yes, but because he's a Madridista, will he end up leaving maybe in a slightly more respectful way? Possibly so. The interesting thing is, will he have the squad which then equips him as a manager and his style of play, or will he adapt in a way and go back to maybe what he learned in his early management years? It's going to be interesting to see. We haven't seen the way that they've managed to play yet, but there's already rumours about people being discontented. Obviously, Ramos wants out. If that is true, then, you know, that's another hole for Benitez to fill. Who's going to sit central midfield, which seems such a key position for him? You know, he doesn't have the likes of Alonso there. He doesn't have a Mascherano-esque player who's going to run around and go crazy. And they've let Khedira go on a free. So it's going to be interesting to see what he builds, who he builds, and who he tries to bring in. It's going to, let's put it this way. If we look into the future, you'd love to see Benitez put it side together to play great football.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, because like one more question for you, Loz, is like, sort of, you know, under Liverpool, Benitez, they were quite like, they dominated centrally in terms of, they had Mascherano, Alonso, Gerard, Torres through the middle, and the wingers were a bit on the peripheral. You look at Gareth Bale and you know, his season he had last season. Do you think he's really going to sort of come back out of his shell in a way under Benitez?
Although I do think that, you know, Benitez has shown in his career that he can appreciate a winger, and he can definitely appreciate a creative player who's dedicated. I mean, you know, you look at Vicente, you look at Aymar, you look at Gerrard even being pushed out to the right wing, and the fact that he wanted to influence things from out wide, but maybe Liverpool never bought the quality out there. So it's not that he doesn't value it. It's that I think, you know, very often he doesn't find himself equipped with great wingers, which now he finds a plethora of at Madrid. So it's going to be interesting to see how, because, you know, we've always seen tactically he's a very you know, essentially knows his stuff, but his man management is not as great, and that's where it let him down, you know, when we saw Bale rip apart Benitez's back line, and, you know, Liverpool at times found out when, you know, maybe the man management wasn't so great. Yossi Benayoun claiming he was bullied towards the end of the time at Liverpool. So there are things in there which I think a lot of people want to see him trip up on. You know, there are people putting stories in the press of, you know, Ronaldo's not happy with Benitez being the new manager, etc., etc. But it's going to be interesting to see what kind of Rafa Benitez goes there. I can, you know, I can see him being sacked at some point, but how respectful we have to be of Benitez, and how the perception maybe influences our look into the future, is an interesting one. I'm going to reserve judgment on this one. I think he'll do a good job with this side, but I think it's going to be interesting to see who he gets in the summer. You know, we've not even seen the transfer window open. Who do you get in defensive midfield for Real Madrid? Anyone got an answer for that?
Big question. You know, the likes of... Go on, Joel. Shoot up.
Luis Gustavo. I think the best two defence midfielders in the world for me on a longer term basis are Gustavo and Busquets. And you're not going to get Busquets. I'd love to see him back in the Premier League. Do you remember that? Was it 2009? He made that rant about Ferguson and the fixtures list.
Well, it was just since then that people seem to have not appreciated Rafa as much.
Oh, so, well, you know, I can't speak Italian. I don't know if he's ranting and raving over there as well. But it'd be fantastic to see some more of those.
I think having spoken to people quite close to Rafa, I think there was a lot of difficulty in leaving Liverpool. It seemed like quite a traumatic process for him, because, you know, it really felt like a place that he was emotionally attached to, and he found it difficult the way that the owners didn't seem to value the things that he said at that time and what he wanted to do. So I think he's not been great at politics. And I just wonder what the fit is at Madrid. You know, he doesn't have to deal with the politics in the same way because of his understanding of Madrid, because of his understanding of the system, because of the way he fits in. Will that mean that he'll feel more at home and he won't feel like he has to prove himself in the same way? It's going to be interesting to see. The inside track is one that you could probably go for maybe a Guillaume Balaguer, someone like that. But I know there are a lot of people who have it in for him. There are a lot of people that want to see him do well. I'd be interested to see how he utilises those wingers and the strengths that that Real side has. Because if there's one thing Benitez is good at, is looking at the strengths of a team and then bringing those out. And, I, you know, if he gets a central defensive midfielder and another centre-back, I think we're going to see a side that could challenge for the league.
Definitely. I think that, you know, someone like James Rodriguez under Rafa Benitez is a match made in heaven. You know, you speak about the work he's done with attacking midfielders in the past. You know, Juan Mata centrally at Chelsea, his best, statistically his best season ever. You look at Gerrard playing that attacking role for Liverpool. You look at Pablo Aimar for his Valencia side. He's got a real history of getting a lot out of attacking midfielders, and I really do think James Rodriguez is going to have an absolutely wonderful year.
Yeah, if again Benitez can build up a relationship with these guys, then we're looking at a good team. And I think that's going to be interesting because he's also going to work the players differently to Carlo Ancelotti. Ancelotti's very laid back, not particularly intense in training apparently, and very much a backseat runner, you know, essentially an Italian, not in a disparaging way. But this is going to be a very different Benitez who demands a lot more from the squad. And I wonder who's going to react well to that within this Real Madrid side. Got a question for both of you guys now. Andrew Goulen says, who are the five young players that could make a big step up next season in the EPL? Joel, I'll come to you first on this one.
If you're asking the PFA, young players could be like Wayne Rooney still, probably. I'm not really sure where the definition ends. I think Liverpool bought fairly well and haven't been given credit for it last transfer window. I mean, you've got players like Markovic, like Emre Can, who are both wonderful talents. And the idea that they should hit the ground running in the first season, like it'd be nice, but I'm not sure it's a necessity. Obviously, some of them went much less well. Balotelli, Lovren, Lambert was never going to set the world on fire, but he wasn't really supposed to. So I'd go firstly with Emre Can and Markovic. I think this year could be Januzaj's year as well. And then after that... Can I stick in Coutinho? Does that count? Yeah,
I'm interested in Liverpool's young guys as well. I mean, Jordan Ibe, Emre Can, and Coutinho, the three guys that everyone seems to list from Liverpool, are three big talents. And Dave, I mean, just tonight you were saying, I mean, this looks interesting for Liverpool's midfield dynamic. And Emre Can has said publicly that he's been basically told he will play in his stronger role of the midfield by Brendan Rodgers. He's sitting for this under-21 German side. And that's what Liverpool have lacked, is the kind of player that Brendan Rodgers thinks is his perfect central defensive midfielder.
Yeah, his role as the game's gone on, obviously he got it on the background, he's sort of moving on into more of a, you know, box-to-box role, holding a bit, attacking a bit. And yeah, I think that...
But that's possible at under-21 level, isn't it? I mean, that's a very different... But it's possible.
I think if the midfield works with Liverpool, if I'd go for the midfield diamond, I think that was fantastic for Liverpool. I'd potentially, you know, if you're going to have Can holding there, then you've got Milner on one side, Henderson on the other, and then Coutinho behind the two strikers. And I think that would really work. You know, the likes of Henderson working back for Can when he decides to burst forward and that type of thing. I think it's a big, big year for Can. I reckon Jordan Ibe is going to have another big year. You know, he's got to step up. Sterling's obviously off. I'm going to mention the Ox as well. Oxlade-Chamberlain, I thought at the start of last season, he was arguably one of Arsenal's best players. It was him and Sanchez that were ripping it up. He got injured, fell out of the team, but I think it's his time to shine. And then I'm going to go put my Man United hat on. I think two players that are going to really come out this season, one of them being Paddy McNair. Every time that he played for Man United, I was very, very impressed. I was very impressed when he played against Chelsea. I thought his confidence on the ball is brilliant. There's a brilliant article in the Belfast Telegraph, obviously quite a niche paper. But
well, just for Belfast, Dave.
Just for Belfast, yeah, obviously. But check out the interview. He talks about how Paddy McNair, when he was a lad, used to practice a lot, you know, 4 or 5 hours after school and that type of thing. And he used to just kick the ball at a wall over and over again. And I think players like that, with composure, with dedication, I really do think he's, you know, Van Gaal has seen something in him. Obviously, he was hauled off against Southampton. He was hauled off, you know, before half-time against another team. But I think he's going to come on. Another one I want to go with, Andres Pereira. Obviously, brilliant player for the under-21s last year. Was the reserve team player of the year. You look at his contribution at the under-20s World Cup. Andres Pereira was directly involved in more goals at the under-21s World Cup than any other Brazilian player. So Brazil got to the final and Pereira registered 2 goals and 2 assists, scoring or assisting a goal about every 74 minutes. And whenever you watch him against, I think obviously when he came on against Serbia, and he came on against somebody else, and he really changed the game. Brilliant, brilliant performance. And I think he's going to explode for Man United. He's been playing sort of a left-hand side role for Brazil, where he's dripping into the 10 slot. played that for United this year. He's got a brilliant delivery from set piece, you know, corners and free kicks against the game against Chelsea in the 21s that was on BT Sport. I think he scored a direct deflected free kick and then whipped in another free kick to, you know, win United the game. And I think that's what Pereira is. He's a sort of game changer. And I do think he's going to come for the forefront of Man United this year.
Anyone interested in the Serbs obviously winning the under 20 World Cup?
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because they won that, but then at the Euro under 21, they're doing atrociously. So maybe all the talent that are in that pool are playing at the under 20 tournament. I don't know. But no, they've got some talented youngsters there, definitely, for sure. And it's going to be interesting to see how they develop. You know, is Serbia going to come back and be strong again?
Andrija Šivković, particularly, is a player that I watch probably too much, given how... But, I mean, he only plays for Partizan, so you can't watch him that much. But he's captained... Has he captained the Serbian national team already? He's certainly the captain of... he's certainly the captain of Partizan at just 18 years old, I think he still is. And as an attacking midfielder that doesn't have a massive physical presence. I found out recently, I'm not really a Football Manager player, but I found out he's a wonder kid on there. I've been watching him a little longer than that. I can hipsterly say. But, yeah, definitely one to look out for from the Serbian under-20s.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, just to jump in, a star at the tournament again. 2 goals, 2 assists, the same as Andres Pereira. Is he at the same level, though, Joel? Or is he better?
I think he's better, but, you know, I don't want to step on your toes.
Go for it, mate, go for it.
There go his toes, let's put it that way. All right, Dave, that's some bad acting. And the final question here comes from Daniel Thompson. Daniel says to us, have you ever, and this is a good question, have you ever fallen out of love with football? Dave, I'll come to you first.
No, never.
Interesting. Joel?
It is difficult given all the social issues that sometimes surround the game. I'm also definitely no. but, you know, sometimes you consider it.
Yeah, for a little while you get a little bit tired around it, but maybe you're not out of love, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, that concludes part two. Let us know if you still love football and whether sometimes you have a little bit too much. Coming up in part three, we're talking our subjects. Part three, and basically we're here with Joel, so it's interesting to ask him a couple of questions while we've got him on. Question one, Joel, how many seconds does Messi have?
Well, at the moment, there's 4,500 or so of us on Twitter, so I think that's the best answer I can give.
Yeah.
I regret that name still, but, you know, you got to stick with it.
Earlier, I was trying to think of other names for you, and I came up with Messi Mins, and then but that also then shortens Messi Seconds to Messi Sex. I was just worried for your future there, if that was the case. Anyway, Dave and I were walking down the street earlier today, and Dave said to me, you know what, Joel's actually quite a fascinating guy. I said, I don't believe it, Dave. He said, I'll prove it. So Dave's basically got a couple of questions for you. Dave, you can take charge of this bit.
Yeah, brilliant. So Joel, obviously you work with Bristol City. I just want to, you know, if you could give the listeners just a bit of an introduction of what you do there, how you got the job, is it fun? And, you know, just go for it.
Firstly, you're both far too kind.
Yeah, we know.
I got the job having to apply to similar things for like 2 years beforehand and failing miserably each time. And with, you know, an improved CV, hopefully, an improved application, I managed it this time. I'm a performance analyst at Bristol City's Academy. So I'll work with like... under 14s or so, up to under 18s, sometimes under 12s, and code their matches, look at their matches, do some data analysis stuff, some medical data analysis. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying it.
How much interaction does that take on a daily basis with players? Or is it more kind of, you know, so obviously, you know, a lot of people don't know what the role of the coaching staff is. They tend to see coaching staff just standing around the side of the pitch chatting. And, you know, having even gone to places like St. George's Park, most of the stuff is done in-house behind closed doors very often because, you know, essentially people feel like it's quite innovative. So how much of that is interaction with managers and players on a daily basis?
Not a huge amount. I'm a university student full time.
Yeah.
So I'm there on 1 or 2 weekdays a week, definitely Sundays, so 2 or 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And I'll interact with coaches more than I do players because, you know, I'm in a fairly junior position.
Yeah. And that's interesting in the first place. Dave, sorry.
Moving on. So obviously you're a big man of the stats like myself. Since you've obviously joined Bristol City, how much stats do they actually use? So have you seen the stuff in terms of, you mentioned obviously you're collecting player data from the youth levels. Do you know how much sort of stats that they use at, you know, first team level? You know, do they, in terms of like passing stats for a game, is that something that they're very much on? Are they on the data hype at the moment?
So I don't really interact with the first team too much. Obviously, there is a disparity in the amount of data you can have at first team level and at academy level.
Yep.
So the kind of data that's created for first team, as I'm sure you'll know, Dave, is the stuff that they create at Opta, which is generally on the ball actions, which is very interesting and does a lot of stuff. It is limited in its own way, but it's fantastic nonetheless. And pro zone data, which again is very interesting, very difficult to analyze if you're doing it by yourself, which is why Prozone offer their own services of data analysis, and is limited in the quantity that you can get. So at the academy, it's slightly less data focused because, you know, you can't get Optostats for under 12s just yet.
Maybe one day we'll get that. In terms of like the stats that you use, could you just give us some like metrics that you're looking at for these sort of under 12s? You know, like you mentioned injury data. I was quite interested about that. Is that, you know, how many times they pulled the hamstring in a season, or what are they looking at there?
That I can't say.
Is that more fitness stuff in a way?
The metrics that I'd be interested in at Bristol, or the metrics that I'd be interested in more generally in a first team environment?
Let's go for a first team environment.
First team environment. So I think in many ways, this is very nerdy. I think in many ways, the philosophy of football statistics isn't always quite right. There's a public obsession, not obsession, because that implies that it's like actively evil. But there's perhaps a misconception that certain counting numbers mean more than they actually mean. Yeah. So assist numbers, for example, vary massively. The goalkeeping stats that are public and well listened to generally mean nothing, because save percentages drop from like 80% to 50% the next season all the time. It happens regularly. There is very, very little reliability from one season to the next season in the save percentage for any goalkeeper. For clean sheets, as Lawrence said earlier, there's so much context behind that it's difficult to say. I'd be looking more into the realms of advanced analytics. So, for example, for goalkeepers, again, it's still very difficult, but you might be looking at a more top-down approach like Goal Impact or like Dan Altman's shots model, although I'm not sure it works for goalkeepers. But also something around expected goals, which is basically like assigning a probability to a particular shot based on like the distance that it is from goal, the type of shot it is, etc. It's not very good at the individual shot level, but when you aggregate those, it's really interesting. And so when you look at those for goalkeepers, you can start to adjust the type of shots they're getting, and then you can maybe look at a better player rating.
From your guys' experience, does that mean that you're seeing a change in the positioning of, say, goalkeepers, depending on what, I mean, do you, when you're watching a match, you must obviously be watching with a slightly analytical eye. Are you seeing a difference in, say, I don't know, maybe, I don't know how much you watch Liverpool, but, you know, I mean, Mignolet before and after coming back.
Before and after Gary Neville.
Essentially, yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something that's difficult to quantify because you need the tracking data, some people have done it brilliantly. There's one guy on Twitter, I think it's Football Fact Man, but I can't remember exactly, who did a brilliant, brilliant analysis on goalkeeping positioning, like you said, but the data isn't really readily available.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
in terms of goalkeeping stats, one really interesting thing that I've sort of spotted this year, David De Gea has been mentioned quite a lot. It's, you know, the amount of catches and drop catches that he's made this season. Obviously, before this season, he was a punching goalkeeper and, you know, couldn't catch anything, went with the double fists a lot, no confidence in his own box. But this season, I think he's dropped one catch all year. So, you know, it's a massive improvement for David De Gea that was probably dropping about, you know, six, maybe seven a season. Quite interesting stats in its own way. But going back to your, you know, the EXP goal models that you're saying, do you think there's enough data available at the moment to make the current model work?
What current model? The expected goals model?
So obviously the expected goals model, it's mapped on, you know, you mentioned shot position and then probability that that shot's going to go in. One thing that I definitely think is missing at the moment that pretty much rules the model out for me is that you don't take into consideration the position of the defenders. Obviously something that you can't get data-wise, but for me, I'm waiting to build that model. I'm waiting for that defensive position. I'm waiting for the goalkeeper position. I'm waiting for how much pressure you've got on the ball and these types of metrics. So what's your opinion there?
So you're right. That's definitely a factor that expected goals misses because you're looking purely at attacking actions. You're looking purely at the types of shots, where those shots come from, etc. And you're not looking at the other side of the coin. I wouldn't discount it, mostly because if you look at a league like the Premier League, expected goals accounts for like 80% of the variance in league position, something like that, 82%. Crazy high numbers of how well these two correlate together. So clearly it means something. Defensive positioning is very interesting. I think you're completely right, but it's so difficult at the moment to get that tracking data. Even more difficult to look at the sensible ways, the good ways, the best practice for using it. I hope that one day it becomes more publicly available. At least I hope that one day I get to be able to use it. But for now, there are better. There are many more metrics than expected goals, and it would be stupid to ever just rely on that. But it is an interesting and it is a useful way of measuring things.
Definitely interesting to go and look up online as well if you're not up to speed on what expected goals is, as I would imagine a lot of people like myself aren't.
If you look up Michael Cayley, so expected goals models vary depending on the statistician. Mm-hmm. Michael Cayley does fantastic going through his expected goals model because so a few of them are public. Mm-hmm. Dan Altman's spoken about it quite a lot and is very interesting on it.
Yeah.
Ted Knutson doesn't post anymore, but was brilliant on the subject. There's lots you can read out there.
He was great on the Really Wild Show. What I was interested in a few years ago, I got invited to go to see the MLS, it was the MLS All-Star Game. It was MLS All-Star Game, but the MLS All-Star Game. One thing they were kind of premiering there, or that we got to see, was they were looking at a whole team tracking system, which meant that each player wear a tracker, if you like, whilst out on the pitch, and you basically, it would be mandatory within the league to do so. It's going to be interesting to see whether they, obviously it didn't catch on straight away, but it's an interesting idea in the first place. We got to speak to the people who make the model. It takes position out on the pitch, and I guess that's the kind of thing that if a whole league was forced to do it, it would be interesting to see where the understanding of coaching goes with that, wouldn't it? Because as say you shut down the odd of one shot, you're opening up other avenues that then people can attack down. So essentially it does, you never completely get rid of the goal threat, but you get it as low as you can. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, it is incredibly interesting. You're completely right. It is very difficult because statistics in football, analytics in football, are trying to look at things that the naked eye perhaps can't. And they're trying to make judgments that might be fallible at a human level and trying to reduce the level of fallibleness.
Yeah, because you can never negate it 100%, if that makes sense.
No, of course not. But with some of the things that you might be talking about, you're looking at what is good in football. That's a very difficult question to answer. It's very difficult to think about a particular situation of how the defenders are organising themselves or the whole team, whatever, and decide that that is a good thing. That is a thing that you want. That is a thing that leads to wins. It's all very well saying that this particular thing is attractive, but if it doesn't correlate to wins, if you can't show how it brings about success in a team, then the link between them is very questionable. Certainly for things like 2v3s, 3v1s, 2v1s on a pitch in attacking and defensive situations. It will be incredibly interesting and incredibly useful. For defensive setups, I'm sure you could look at the symmetry of defensive setups and how they move together. I'm sure there's lots of interesting stuff to go about there. But I think we might be quite a long way off any of that being in the public sphere.
Dave?
One problem we have at the moment as well is the EU currently has a law that says you can't fit a GPS to a person, so we can't track these players. But there's definitely companies out there that are looking into player tracking in terms of using cameras.
It's only on the bloody pitch, Dave. I mean, it's not a problem. Yeah, it's not. It's not like
you know. If I was in charge, Loz, I'd let everyone do it. But the problem is, I think as soon as it comes out, the clubs are going to be very protective of that data, because obviously that data, you could spot weakness. You can spot if a player lags after, you know, 35 minutes, if their sprint levels go down to, say, 50%, you know, a ball over the top of that man, you're clean for on goal. Clubs are going to be very defensive with this data. But, you know, it, like, if Joel continues his work and, you know, with clubs, he might have his hands on it in the future.
But that, I mean, that's quite an interesting side to it, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, essentially, what I find interesting about both your answers, both of you as data analysts and me as not as one, is that, although I do love a bit of data, the point would be with this is that actually there's a big difference between the data itself and the narrative that then someone puts onto that, or there's a big difference in the data and then what someone tries to quickly turn around an article, so they need to throw a stat in there to do a point quote comment style of article. So very often it's not like you say, Joel, it's not necessarily the most fitting of stat to go with what you maybe want to make your point, but some people just need stats, if that makes sense, to make points. And maybe there's a difference between journalism and the statisticians, but the public facing side of it is one that's evolving. And that's interesting because, I mean, I had this conversation with a guy at Adidas a few years ago. We were saying, if you're giving statistics to fans live at the match, you know, if they can log on their iPhone and see that, you know, Glenn Johnson isn't doing such a good job on the right hand side for Liverpool, which maybe seems obvious to the naked eye for some people, then you know are they going to start booing him, or does it change the way does it change the openness, the way that a club approaches it? Because it changes a whole culture, essentially. It's not just changing in isolation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I don't mean to be too much of a dick about
go ahead
the use of stats in the public sphere. No, I mean what I've said previously.
Yeah.
Regardless of how they're used, the very fact that stats are now commonly used in football media means that that interest is generated. It means that even if information is potentially in some places misleading, it means that at least people are talking about it. At least some people will develop that interest. But I think that can only be a positive thing. Will it change the sport? I think doomsday predictions are a bit too much. If you want to just cheer for your team, just cheer for your team. The decisions behind closed doors are as secretive, if not less secretive, than they were before. Because I imagine when you're bringing about a more forward-thinking way of looking at football, you're also perhaps thinking about including fans. Like in Germany, where Dave was completely right in saying that some football stats, the football clubs are quite selfish in their use of those. But that's not so much true in Germany, where they share tapes of like everything.
They're very into that, aren't they?
Yeah.
I guess that's the thing, is the sharing culture is different. Yeah.
I hope it doesn't change the way we look at football. Football is an emotional spectacle. It should be an emotional spectacle. And if you're interested in another way of looking at it, then, you know, fantastic. Hopefully it doesn't take away from anyone else's enjoyment.
Well, that's the interesting side, isn't it? Is it has the potential to be an emotional spectacle. But that doesn't mean that for everyone it is. You know, you can approach it in another way. I loved the quote from Barney Roney, who said, and I think Jonathan Wilson has said as well, who said, they just love a nil-nil. And the emotion that they get from a nil-nil, whereas other people would say that's the, you know, one of the least emotional results that they believe they can get, just because, you know, you don't get the emotional relation of a goal, etc. I mean, Dave, we probably have to draw this to a close now because we've probably been going for about 4 hours. I just want to know what statistic do either of you have a favourite statistic that is kind of your go-to thing? Do you have a go-to stat? Is it XG? Is it?
I love a good chance creating chances and key passes and assists. Now, obviously, they're hated by the statistics community, but I think there's real trends in that data when you drill it down to. You know, season on season, where the chances are coming from. Is this the first time that they've, you know, got to that level? That's for me. I like looking at trends more than a certain stat, but if it was one stat, it'd be chances created.
And Joel?
I don't hate chances created and key passes at all.
Why are you being a dick, Joel? You do hate it. Come on, you don't be a dick.
No, I think they're much more interesting than something like assists are. So it's a good answer. I'd go for goal impact is my favourite.
What is goal impact? What does that jargon mean?
So goal impact is something set up by a guy called Jörg Seidel, who's out in Germany, in Hamburg, I think. And he has this wonderful system. It's a I think he also uses it professionally, but it is publicly available, so it's not a purely academic exercise. He has this wonderful system of rating players according to essentially the goal difference that they contribute to a team per 90 minutes. It's adjusted for all sorts of things. It's adjusted for age curve, home, away, league quality, absolutely everything. Yeah. And for me, there are probably measures that do better than it. Perhaps Daniel Altman again, Ted Knutson do some brilliant work, which might surpass it. Or I don't mean like surpass it in future, I mean already above it.
Yeah.
But as a way of measuring everything, as a way of measuring leadership, as a way of measuring determination, adaptability, the contribution to a team outside of counting numbers, where you have to create a narrative, if you're looking at something top down, just how much this player contributes to a team, for me, you're looking at... for one single number, if you ask me to go for that,
yeah,
you're looking at the closest you can get in one metric to an objective way of looking at football.
That's very interesting. There are two of my favourite stats. One's results. I fucking love results. It's how many goals have gone in and whether you've won or lost. Mate. That's the only thing that fucking matters for me, mate, at the end of the day. That's the only stat that I need when I pick up the Telegraph or the Sun on a Sunday, and also APP, which is Adams per podcast, and that can be directly translated into JPP, which is Joel's per podcast, and we've had 1.0 of those, let's put it that way, and maybe we've had 1.5, because I feel like this has been a really good podcast from Joel.
It's been lovely.
Thank you so much.
Hopefully we'll get you back soon, Joel, because that was really insightful, and I'm sure
it would be a pleasure.
There'll be more questions from people who maybe haven't spoken about this, or maybe are studying a similar thing to you, or just have their own thoughts on statistics in the first place. I imagine one of the comments will be along the lines of, statistics are bullshit, it doesn't really matter, and the rest will probably be very complimentary.
Statistics are bullshit.
But they're a bullshit you can get a degree for now. So,
hey, man, back off, yeah?
Brilliant answer. Brilliant.
Dave, your job is worthless to me. Squawker's a great company. Anyway, it's been wonderful to have you guys. Thanks a lot for joining us. If people want to find you online, Joel, where do they go?
YouTube.com/messyseconds or mm-hmm. Twitter.com/messyseconds. If you're into the football without the me, then Messy Minutes also does a good job of that on Twitter.
Very interesting. And of course, Dave, where can people find you?
Oh, it's classic, isn't it? Just at Squawker Dave on Twitter. And the rest of the links are there. Go there, like the picture, get involved.
Yes, like the picture, I believe. I like the bigger picture we're painting here. If you want to find me online, go to @LozCast, LOZCAST, and come ask questions. We'd love to hear more from you guys. Hopefully we'll see you again soon. Joel, it's been a real pleasure to have you. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me.
Best of luck to Bristol next season. It's going to be good when you guys get promoted, and we can say we called it here first.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Anyway, we'll see you again soon. Thanks a lot for joining us on the front three. Adam will be back to join the regular service again next week. But have a good one until then.